Okay, hi everybody, and I hope you can hear me. We are resuming with Identify as Being. It is kind of our alternative curriculum. It's not exactly the kind of curriculum upon which Master DK lays particular emphasis, but it is something that he frequently hints at. And you know, when he does hint at it, he seems to suggest that it is a rather difficult proposition. And that our usual thoughts about it will have to be altered. Now, I often think it's not so much about altering thought per se. Actually, he doesn't really say that. He just implies that our usual judgments about it are not correct. It's not so much about thought as it is about a different type of perception, a kind of feeling, which is not really astral. It's the way Master Moria uses feeling, and it has to do with the heart and with buddhi, which we are presently studying. So if we try to understand this strictly with the cognitive faculties, we will not really succeed. It really has to be, well, I mean, we may have thoughts, and the thoughts may be interesting and even in a way correct, but we will not have intimacy with our subject. And, you know, and when it happens, this kind of intimacy with this new type of perception of the, what I've been calling the pervasive factor, the pervasiveness or being, we will know it. And, you know, it can be, in a way, activated at any time, according to the intention and according to the will, once we understand that it's not the form or any kind of multiplicity that may be perceived. I mean, that's interesting, all right. I mean, and important when we live in this great universe of Maya. But it is the underlying factor of all those forms, which is the identical factor and produces identicality in the face of infinite variety. Think about that. The identification with, or better, as identicality in the face of infinite perception or infinite multiplicity. Now, you know, these are kind of philosophical terms, but we are studying, in a way, occult philosophy. Now, there is so much that's practical in our work, and we are designated as helpers behind the scenes, invisible helpers, in a way, not technically, you know, those are the people that work at night in their astral body. I remember, you know, I'm going to digress, but I remember visiting with the last living disciple in the Tibetan group. She was the youngest. And she was talking about the Normandy invasion, where the Allies or the United Nations got together and landed at Normandy beaches. And she was talking about functioning as an invisible helper. And she said that she and others were holding the soldiers up as they were sinking in the water or wading ashore in the water. You know, it was some kind of subjective assistance, you know, a very practical kind of thing. And like DK sometimes says, you know, for a while a person is put to work as an invisible helper. Whether or not the brain records that, you know, those events at night, in her case it did, because, you know, she was a pretty high disciple and right there, you know, with Alice Bailey and in the more intimate circle. But we help in various practical ways, and we work as consciously as we can with the new group of world servers. And, you know, we work for the souls of nations lately, and we're working in the field of education and psychology and the New World Religion, you know, certain of those seed group areas. Our kinds of groups focus on more than others. So we are doing practical work. That's the point. It's practical work, and yet it is esoteric work. But this kind of curriculum that we're dealing with right now, is to change our entire perception, if we can. And, you know, sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And increasingly, it will be there. And we will notice, as in the Yoga Sutras, that the whole universe is, as it were, inside us, rather than a subject-object relationship. Basically, what we have to do is, we have to negate the usual subject-object relationship through the act of identification. And if you say the word with, identifying, this identifies with that, the language creates a duality. But if we say we identify as that, then that duality is much reduced, and we begin to perceive ourselves as the pervasive factor, regardless of how much variety is presenting itself to our normal perception. So just think about that for a minute. The pervasive factor, we are that, regardless of how much variety. DK is interesting. He calls this variety a kind of, he uses the word phantasmagoria, as if it is the product of the imagination or fantasy making faculty. And he includes in that what he calls associated persons. It's all part of the phantasmagoria with which we have forever, literally forever, to deal cyclically. But we also want to know how to perceive the pervasive factor amidst all the phantasmagoria. Now, he has a word for that. He sometimes says it's a good word, and sometimes he doesn't like the word. It's called isolated unity. And it is, it begins at the third initiation, but it isn't really perfected, or at least it doesn't reach its optimal usefulness until mastership, the fifth initiation. And basically what it is, the perceiver isolates the unity within all variety. The perceiver isolates the unity or the sameness or the being or the pervasive factor, whatever you want to call it, within all the variety. Now, the age of Aquarius is a particularly good time to do that, because somehow Aquarius, this sign of universality, is able to deliver what is called unity in diversity, or diversity in unity. And then we can be on, if that is delivered to us, and we can begin to perceive in that way through what I've called infusception, then we're much closer consciously to the reality that we are. You know, reality too is a very relative term. We use it in a very prosaic way, you know, like what do the senses report, and that's real. And if we have a dream or something, that's unreal. But all of that can be considered a relative reality, but the ultimate reality is being itself. And one day, using the heart center, which is connected with Buddhi, we will perceive, come on intimate terms with this underlying reality, which is the same everywhere and is the same whatever, in good and in bad. It really is beyond good and evil. In relativity, there is good and evil. But when it comes to ultimate reality, there's only one thing, and you can't even call it a thing, and you know, Blavatsky begins to talk about it in the beginning of The Secret Doctrine, and you know, that is the absolute, that is reality. Now, it's unapproachable by thought, and it's unapproachable, and it cannot be perceived, really. But we can begin to tell what it is not, using the ancient Vedic Brahmanical method, neti neti, not this, not that, not this, not that. And then finally, you know, we're left with a much more intimate becoming of reality. We consciously become the reality we have always been. But, you know, you have to kind of, in our relative myopic state, we have to kind of work at that. Otherwise, we'll just keep everything cognitive, everything will be mental, you know, interesting, but not heartfelt. Not Buddhically apprehended, and that, you know, you can go beyond Buddhic apprehension too. The Hindus or the, you know, Brahmanists, the Vedantists, they have their own varieties of samadhi, and there are layers of it that penetrate ever deeper through identification into the reality of within the universe. So you have to keep both things going, really. You need the sense of the underlying reality, which, you know, the theologian Paul Tillich, he called the ground of all being, the ground of all being. But you need the relativity also, the Maya, you need that. And I'm using Maya in a big philosophical sense. I'm not just using it as that distraction kind of thing, which we all are subject to when we carry out our bad habits. And we don't think about what we're doing. We're not conscious, we're just automatic. That's a kind of Maya also. So anyway, we're engaged in an attempt to come into more intimate terms with the reality we are, ever closer to it, ever closer to it, until we realize that we are it. And that requires the heart. You know, the Buddhi, which we're studying now a little bit in the beginning of the Glamour book, it requires the mind too. It's very important, but mind alone won't do it. It's got to be the transcendental mind, which is Buddhi, and, you know, related to Mercury, Jupiter, and Neptune, the three planets that connect with the second initiation, and two of them connect with monadic awareness on the second cosmic subplane, and that is Jupiter and Neptune. So we need to use those influences in order to get beyond the limitations of the mind, which somehow keeps this separate from that. This and that are really the same. And somehow we have to feel that and know that and practice that, you know, with what your senses reveal, or with what your imagination shows you. You practice, and you think of your heart. And then when it clicks in, so to speak, you know you're there. Or at least more there than you were. Now, I'd just like to, you know, say hi and welcome you. And it's not so easy to do on this particular thing, but, well, Michael Stacy is helping us, always behind and in front of the scenes there, making sure we stay connected. And then Anne. Hi, and Anne Veronica, and Anne Parker, and Annette Ebert, Avon, Madison, hi, and Catherine, P, I guess, Catherine Pyre, hi, and Eric Husemans, hello, good to see you here, and Georgina Sprague, hi, and Heike Bobert, hello, and Joe is here too with us, usually helping to guide all these things. And Joan Schofield, hi. And Juhi Lee, hi. And let's see, I have a little trouble getting this. Yeah, Karen Gritzke, hello, Karen. Loretta Letendre, hi. And Lorianne Smith, hi. And Lorraine Pridle, good to see you. And Lynn Merguria, good to see you. Risto, maybe our one Finnish member here. Maybe two is tuned in somewhere. And Tia, hello. And I think that's as far as I go there. Anyway, glad you are here with us. So look, you know, these are obscure matters because we're not used to thinking in this way. And if you look at this big map, well, maybe I'll try not to make it quite so big. This one, perhaps. So many of our thoughts are generated in the concrete mind at the top of the lower 18 subplanes, which really constitute, for sure, the dense physical body of our planetary logos in a cosmic sense. And then occasionally we will access our gifts of many lives, and maybe we can be thinking within our causal body, which is part of the dense physical body of the solar logos, 21 subplanes. The higher mental plane is in a peculiar position with respect to the planetary logos, but for sure, the higher mental plane is definitely cosmically physical when it comes to our solar logos instead of the planetary logos. And then, can we ever really get into abstract thought? Well, we had a session on that, I think, and we began to think about the big formulas which embrace so many concrete instances. They are formulations by human beings trying to understand what the intuition sees directly. I would say that abstract mind is not direct perception. And if we look through the books carefully, we will see that abstract mind is a high formulation, but not straight knowledge, which is something Master Moria asks us to develop, just the way the Tibetan asks us to develop the intuition. So really, what we're working on now is the realm where straight knowledge begins, and that is the Buddhic plane. And we began to see, interestingly, you know, every subplane, all of the seven subplanes of the Buddhic plane have their own particular powers. Now, the powers of the first and second subplane are so high that even the master does not approach them. He doesn't really deal with them because they belong to the Chohans. So we don't know what they are. They just stay blank. And so it goes, as you know, for the higher two subplanes of the Atmic plane, and probably for all of the powers on the monadic plane and on the logoic plane. Probably we generalize those powers by just calling them monadic awareness. but we don't know the specifics. And one day when we are Chohans, we will know the specifics. So we're reaching into the Buddhic plane at the moment, and you know, maybe next time we'll maybe get as far as the idea of what is spiritual will, because that is also an aspect of what we are studying in this spiritual triad, which is a kind of a personal, or you know, an elevated personal reflection of the monad. It's like the personality of the monad, just the way the personality is the personality that reflects the soul. And there are all kinds of things going on the Buddhic plane. However, the term intuition per se is so connected with the number four that it is found on the fourth subplane of the Buddhic plane, which is absolutely the midway point for the subplanes above and the subplanes below. 21, 22, 23, 24. Yeah, it's the 25th subplane up and the 25th subplane down. There is no up and down, you know, but we're talking about progressive points of tension. So these points of tension are measured by work that goes on the different subplanes. And the intuition is absolutely right in the middle, looking above and looking below. And then other things are found, you know, divine vision and healing and the comprehension of the four sounds below. And then above, immediately above, is found idealism. But beyond that, for subplane number, well, what can I call it, 25, 24, 23 and 22? Anyway, subplane number one and two here, we just don't know. We don't even have a name. We don't even have a name for it. But what we're trying to do is make our consciousness a lot more refined than it is right now. Now, I think we would be shocked to realize how much concrete mindedness goes into our daily thought life. And I heard a story, I don't know whether I heard it from Marion Walter, that older and yet younger disciple who was a member of the DK's group, was it Alice Bailey that said so? But she said that sometimes the Tibetan wouldn't work with her because her concrete mind was just too active. And the higher types of impression could not come through because the concrete mind would block them. So he just said, well, another day. So we realize, and maybe I've mentioned it before, that when we study with the new schools, especially the new schools of meditation in the future, we are helping to get rid of the dominance of the concrete mind. It's just overly active. And, you know, you'll find that in the kind of studies that we're working on right here, concrete mindedness is an inhibitory factor. And here, I just want to ask you, everybody, make sure you have your video off at this time. You know, somewhere in your control bar, it says stop the video, so stop the video. And, you know, it's not easy to find that, but once you found it, you'll always know it. Like, for instance, if I stop my video right now, I just disappear, don't I? So one of our guests that just came in has to do the same. Or Michael, Stacy, maybe you can help with that. Okay, so we're looking at the intuition, and then we go to the glamour book. We go to the glamour book in the beginning of it. All I got to do is find it. There it is. To see a little bit more. Now, we read last time and thought about it that intuition is not like knowing that something's going to happen, or being able to size up another person really quickly because you have an intuition about how they are, you know, you just know. It's not even necessarily, you know, knowing what's going to happen next, you know, or I have an intuition, I bet on this horse and the horse wins, I had an intuition. No, it's something much, much bigger thing. So we read. That the intuition is a comprehensive grip of the principle of universality. And when it is functioning, there is momentarily at least a complete loss of all sense of separateness. Think about that. Now, separateness occurs when you validate the reality of boundaries. Now, remember, the very first fundamental of the secret doctrine is that there is a boundless, immutable principle. That doesn't, it's not just at the perimeter of this, whatever it is, that we have boundlessness, but there's no boundaries within it. There's no within it at all. There's no inside. There's no outside. It's entirely boundless. So when you can look at variety all around you and invalidate the boundaries that you appear to see or detect under myopic influence, you're well on your way to losing the sense of separateness. When you can look at the variety around you and invalidate the boundaries by means of the heart, invalidate the boundaries which you seem to see, then you're well on your way to overcoming the great heresy of separateness. So he goes on and says, at its highest point, talking about intuition, it is known as that universal love, which has no relation to sentiment, which is kind of like liking and disliking, or to affectional reaction, which is very much the same as sentiment. I'm attracted, I'm not attracted to the form, including the subtle forms, but is predominantly in the nature of an identification with all beings. Now, there isn't any perception that's not a being, or artificially at least, a composite of many tiny beings, atoms, subatomic particles, cells. You know, there's no such thing as inanimate matter. So basically, the whole universe is alive, you know. It's called hylozoism, Blavatsky brought this out, and everything you see is a being. Perceptions are beings. Not the kinds of beings we're used to necessarily when we talk about the human kingdom, the animal kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, but all perceptions really are self-perceptions of the great logos, universal logos, and all perceptions are beings. It may take some pondering. And then, you know, another way of saying this is that to be is to be perceived. Now that is an existence exists because it is perceived, and all perceptions are self-perceptions. And there's only one game in town and one actor, and the whole mystery is my story, if you know what I mean. The my story is only one. So universal love, well, we begin how we can. And it's not about I like you, I don't like you, I'm attracted to you, I'm not attracted to you. That's not it. That's all in the realm of desire. It's something much more unitive and deeper. And then when that happens, then is true compassion known, then does criticism become impossible. It's not like, you know, biting your tongue. We have this old saying, oh, bite your tongue. My grandmother always used to say it to me. That's not the impossibility of criticism or of any adverse statement. You just can't, when you're in this state of identification, you cannot criticize, because as DK says, he basically says that to understand all is to forgive all. So cultivate the great understanding. We'll talk about that. Then only is the divine germ seen as latent in all forms. In other words, the essence is latent in all self-perceptions. Intuition is light itself. And when it is functioning, the world is seen as light. And the light bodies of all forms become gradually apparent. Now, in the Kabbalah, we basically get the idea that the whole universe of Maya is condensed light. Now, how does that condense? I mean, you know, there are probably hyper chemical and physical rules for condensation, but it's all an act of perception, of self-perception. The one great action of the one great universal being has to do with imagination and perception. That's what moves things around. That's what changes relationship. It's sort of like perception. Self-perception is the hand of God at work, changing, rearranging, putting into new relationship. So anyway, seeing the light. In that light, we shall see light. In the light of the mind, if taken far enough, we shall begin to see the intuition, what the intuition reveals, a greater light. And this brings with it the ability to contact the light center in all forms. Maybe that comes first, you know, there's a love center and a being center. And thus again, an essential relationship is established. And, you know, talking about how we all get along or don't the sense of superiority and separateness recedes into the background. Well, you know, DK deals with the Lords of the Dark Face. You know, he deals with the Brothers of Materialism, and he says, but look, yes, they are still brothers. And, you know, if you really stop to think about it, somehow you and I are functioning through them too. There's only one actor. There's only one process. There are no varieties of beings that are ultimately real. They are myopic and have to be dealt with. But even the bad guys, you know, it's just one being that is functioning. So this gets into issues about good and evil and so forth. I promised you, no, that was a different class. Maybe it was this class, that we would get into Dr. Anna Kingsford's channeling. And I think Michael located that for me on page 60-something of the Cosmic Fire book. Okay, so intuition, therefore, brings with it the appearance of three qualities, and it brings illumination. Okay. Brings that. It brings understanding. And I wonder if I can get any nice... I like blue for understanding. It's probably going to cover the whole thing up. Okay. Oh, that's not too good. Oh, there it is. Oh, and then something happened to my illumination. It turned a different color. Let's see if I can do that. Yeah, try that one. Oh, that's nice. And then it brings one more factor, love. So, you know, we want to look at that. And again, understanding and love, loving understanding. Maitreya meaning loving understanding. So, you know, I'll use the blue again. Illumination. By illumination, I don't mean the light in the head. Now, DK tells us that is dependent on the quality of the brain cells and special, you know, material considerations. It might appear to some people, it might not, and they might be very intuitive. So this light in the head, which does seem to accompany the soul's influencing of the pineal gland and the area around it, is incidental and phenomenal. It's not germane, it's not essential. And it is in the, it's not noumenal, it's phenomenal. The noumenon is the subtle cause of the phenomenon. And many truly intuitive people are entirely unaware of this light. So, you know, maybe it's just the way the brain cells are stimulated and their own particular quality, and maybe it has to do something with the kind of ray that is affecting the brain. Usually, rays 3 and 7, but not exclusively. There's a special relationship with ray 1 in regards to illumination, and there are some people that have that ray 1 brain, which is the same, basically, as the ray 1 physical body. The light to which I refer is that which irradiates the way. Now, sometimes DK uses the word path, and sometimes he uses the word way. And I have found that the word way, Well, we hear of the path of evolution mostly, or the path of initiation, and we hear of the way of higher evolution, which is the great choice made at the sixth initiation. But maybe he's just using this in a generalized manner, and way means all kinds of progress. The light to which I refer is that which irradiates the way. We have to know where we're going, we don't get off the track, and we choose the path which is ours to choose, and that is the way we go. It is the light of the intellect. And sometimes the word intellect, when the Neoplatonists are using it, it means a lot more than just the cognitive abilities. It actually means an intuitive type of getting inside something and telling what it is, being able to detect what it is. It is the light of the intellect, which really means that which illumines the mind held steady in the light, maybe from a higher source, and which reflects itself in that mental apparatus which is held steady in the light of the soul. It is the light of the intellect, which really means that which illuminates or illumines the mind. We all want to have that illumined mind. And in this case, it's coming from the soul's reflection of the Buddhic plane, and ultimately from Buddhi itself. So something higher is illuminating the mind. And that illumination come is the quality of that something higher. And this is the light of the world. I am the light of the world, said the Christ, and I don't know if the Buddha said it, maybe Hermes Trismegistus said it, the Buddha is the Lord of light. Think about, just for a second, being light. See, we're so used to looking in the mirror and saying, well, that's who I am, or thinking about our feelings and saying, oh, well, that's what I am, and thinking about our thoughts, you know, I think, therefore I am. We're so used to identifying what we are with form that it's difficult, maybe, to think of ourselves as formless light, which preceded the condensation of light in the creation of form. So we somehow have to, if I can put it this way, deformalize our identity and stop thinking about ourselves as if we were form. Yes, we have to deal with the form that has appeared in the Maya we have self-generated, but in essence, no, we're not form. So this is the light of the world, a reality which is eternally existent, but which can be discovered only when the interior light is recognized as such. Well, the great teachers, they have recognized this light of the world. I am the light of the world. Yes, I think the Buddha is included. The Christ, the Buddha, and Hermes Trismegistus, thrice great Hermes. This is the light of the ages, which shineth evermore until the day be with us. In other words, it leads us unerringly to participate eventually in the great universal pralaya, which is the dissolution of any particular universe. That's the day be with us. Another day be with us is also the glorification of any great being. There's a day be with us for our solar logos and for our cosmic logos and for the one about whom naught may be said, and on. A day be with us is a day of glorification. A day of glorification. And I wonder if I can, well, I don't want to note a day of glorification. We'll see what happens here when I do this. Oh, stubborn. Let's see what happens. No, it's not going where I thought it would. No. Well, anyway. The intuition is therefore the recognition in oneself, not theoretically, and here's the point, but as a fact in one's experience of one's complete identification with the universal mind. Where do we find that? It's cosmic. Of one's constituting a part of the great world life. The world can be the universe. And of one's participation in the eternal persisting existence, which is being itself. Oh, well, I'll just make all of it yellow, you know? Mercury, the yellow of Mercury is indicating one of those intuitive planets. Mercury is that. It's the transcendental mind. And when we have Mercury working for us, we have more than just cognitive, formulative mind. We have the mind which really has straight knowledge and sees. So this is a different kind of light. This illumination doesn't have to do with form. It is a revelatory quality, all the way up to the height of any universe. I'm using terms that have to be taken symbolically. This is the light of the world. Think of it. You are the light of the world. You too. I too. We are the light of the world. It's a big stretch. There's no pride in it at all. Nothing higher, lower, you know, we're all the light of the world. A reality which is eternally existent, but which can be discovered only when the individual interior light is recognized as such. So we activate the Buddhic faculty somehow, and then begin to recognize the greater universal light in graded series of recognitions. This is the light of the ages which shineth evermore until many days be with us along the way, until finally the universal day be with us dawns and the great universal pralaya occurs. Preceding the dissolution of the universe, and then its reemergence at a appointed time. How long can you hold your breath? You know, the great breath is holding its breath. Is there a law to it? Is there a determination of how many units of time consist in the in-breath? when there is no universe? And do all universes last the same amount of relative time? Well, you know, these are questions, but we just have to speculate. The intuition is therefore the recognition in oneself, not theoretically, but as a fact in one's experience of complete identification with the cosmic mind, at whatever level that is accessible. The Buddha accessed that, the cosmic touch, just amazing, really, at his sixth initiation. And the Christ accessed the cosmic astral touch. Complete identification with one's universal mind, of one's constituting a part and an indivisible part of the great world life, meaning we are the universal logos, and of one's participation in the eternal persisting existence, which for practical purposes is the universal logos. It's really much more. I'll put that in red, you know, because sometimes in red, even though it's not necessarily about Ray One, it does call our attention to things. Okay. Now, maybe a little more. Oh my goodness. This business of the intuition, I'm having my doubts whether we should get into it. So light, understanding, and love. Illumination, understanding, and love. And I think that in order to go deeply, we must not venture into what understanding is right at this moment. But an hour has passed, you know, with me going on and on, Gemini thing. And next time, we'll deal with understanding. And of course, those two things go together, loving understanding. That is Maitreya's, the meaning of his name, loving understanding. And let's just say that the heart has eyes. There is revelation in the perception, which is actuated from what we call the heart. Now, we have so many hearts, you know. We have a heart between the shoulder blades, in the very center of the head center. We have a heart in the head center on the astral plane, and we have the entire causal body as a heart, and who knows, on the second subplane of the Buddhic plane, what we would find. We don't know, it's just not given. And then we have the heart that is the monad. The monad is 12-fold, and it's called the higher 12, which really fits because, you know, the 12th sign is Pisces, which is all about the Father's home. I leave the Father's home, and turning back, I save. It's a Pisces thing. And the number is 12. And then we can go on and on, because DK actually does list a whole series of hearts. But as far as we're concerned, it's probably the great cosmic heart etherically demonstrating on the logoic plane. There is something above that, but the etheric demonstration of a cosmic heart is probably found on the second level of the logoic plane. That's a speculation. Anyway, we have a bunch of hearts, and in cosmic fire and an esoteric astrology, which may be lifted out of cosmic fire, those hearts are listed and very interesting. But we'd be doing well enough to really activate the Buddhic connection with the heart between the shoulder blades. That would be a whole new difference in perception, and it would be a much more intimate relationship with reality and as reality. It would bring us closer to identification. Seems like the heart is active at every initiation. You know, Leo, for the first initiation, it rules the heart, as we know. And we have Jupiter and Neptune, both heart-related at the second initiation. And we have the whole causal body being transfigured or glorifying the personality at the third initiation. And we have the destruction of that causal heart at the fourth initiation, after which the Buddhic plane becomes really active in the intuitive sense, and the monad, another heart, has a direct connection with the consciousness at the fourth initiation. And then at the fifth initiation, it's Leo again. And some, I don't know, there's a heart on every second subplane, you know. Atmic heart. How interesting. The second subplane of the atmic plane for the master. And then for the Chohan, the whole monadic plane is the residence of the heart center. You know, I know I'm off on a tangent here, but if I were to show you this, you would see in these triangles down here that the heart center is always found on the second subplane, whether it's etheric, astral, and, you know, probably we're talking about the importance of the second subplane here in terms of heart expression of the egoic lotus. And then what is here on the second subplane of the intuitional plane, or the Buddhic plane, or the second subplane of the Nirvanic plane, or all of these second subplanes? They have to be, I would say, according to the law of analogy, they have to be a series of hearts taking us all the way up to the planetary logoic heart and the solar logoic heart, which is on the cosmic mental plane and beyond. So there's a lot going on that DK did not fill in. You know, he just couldn't. You know, if it's beyond what a master can deal with, then how are we supposed to have any kind of notion about it? But I just want to close this little discussion by saying 35 vortices of force make a master. Now think about that. 35 vortices of force make a master, which means that all four etheric subplanes on the atmic plane are populated by chakras, as are the four ethers of the Buddhic plane. Now, I'm going to extend that by saying that 42 vortices of force make a Chohan. And I'm going to say that the four etheric subplanes of the monadic plane are populated by chakras, which extend down into the lower chakras. And we have no idea about, you know, what they really are how they got there and what their interplay is. Every once in a while, he gives a little hint. And I'm going to say, according to the law of analogy, that 49 vortices of force make a Chohan of the seventh degree. And I'm going to go to the four higher subplanes of the logoic plane and say that they are populated by chakras. And so the etheric component of every one of these planes, you know, they're really cosmic subplanes, all add up to 49. And that whatever starts way up here makes its way down through the chakra system of every one of these solar planes, or systemic planes, if you want to call them, or cosmic subplanes, if you want to call it that. So, you know, look, you know, DK gives us the ABCs. We can't take any more than that. And we have the right or the obligation to extend what he has given with intelligent speculation so that we might move on a few levels into the nature of what is implied by what he has given, which is all that I'm doing there when I use the number 42 and 49. And then don't forget, you know, when we go on to the other cosmic planes, we're going to have chakras as well. Where does the chakra system ever cease in universe? I think it probably doesn't. And probably at the very height of the universe, using that symbolic phrase, when the one becomes the two, becomes the three, becomes the seven, there is some kind of universal chakric system, which is the source of the seven rays and extends through every septenate on every level all the way down to the tiniest being. Probably there's order like that among the subatomic particles, and who knows where it stops. Maybe it stops with what's called bubbles of the koilon. You know, if you read the first principles of theosophy by Jinnara Jadasa, he was the head of the Theosophical Society back in the late 20s. It's a nice simplified presentation of many theosophical concepts, which suggest that descent of the very highest to the very lowest. And he deals with the bubbles in the koilon. Now, the bubble in the koilon is the tiniest particle on the cosmic, on the systemic physical plane. But are the bubbles in the koilon divisible? Do they exist on other cosmic planes? Are they still tinier and still more simple? Atoms are, maybe the bubbles also are. So look, you know, we don't know what the biggest thing is. We don't know what the smallest thing is. We just know that any universe is finite. Otherwise it would last forever, which would defile or defy the law of periodicity, which is the second fundamental of the secret doctrine. All right. So now, if you have thoughts that you want to bring forward or questions, you know, look, this is cosmology, isn't it? We're into cosmological work. We don't have the advantage immediately of cosmic fire in front of us, word for word, line for line, but the thoughts naturally go towards the big view of which we are all a part and which we all finally are. So it is mind expanding. It's supposed to be. and it's supposed to be intuition promoting. And eventually, will empowering. So we'll see what we can do with the will a little bit later on. Okay, questions, thoughts, whatever. And Michael, you help me out here if there's anybody.
I'm keeping an eye out for any hands raised or questions, comments written in the chat box.
Okay.
So far, none.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I know it takes I don't know what I would do. It takes a certain amount of courage, you know, to ask questions or make comments about this kind of stuff.
And we do have from Heike.
Yes.
So, if I contemplate on something, identify and get straight knowledge, I would call it intuition.
Oh. Yeah, my son calling, can't do it. Yeah, if I contemplate on something and get straight knowledge, yes. Yes, go ahead.
If I contemplate on something, identify and get straight knowledge, I would call it intuition as a question.
I would say, you know, I would say that a particular level of your intuition would be active when you get straight knowledge of something. And I tend to, in the scope of this course, I tend to call such contemplation, I call it infuception. So, I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't do this, but it's done now. So I would say that you are infusiving. I make up the word. It's a identification with the pervasive factor. Now, when you are dealing with a few steps below that, and you're dealing with pure reason, and you contemplate something, and you get immediate knowledge about what you're contemplating, and the word is contemplating, by the way, so that's a good choice of words, then that is a level of the intuition. And I would even say that infusception, you know, the ability to infusive rather than just perceive, is a kind of elevated intuition. See, there's an intuition which reveals relationship, and that I call pure reason. And there's an intuition which reveals being, and that I call infusception. So sometimes you just want to know how everything is related to everything else. And I think the light of intuition can reveal that with straight knowledge and via what's called pure reason. But sometimes you don't care about how things are related. Doesn't make any difference because those things are illusory anyway. And what you want is the pervasive factor. And that would be infusception, which is a kind of ultimate self-perception of the universal logos of itself. And, you know, to me, they are like two different approaches. When I'm reading DK, who is a master of meticulous entirety, just look up what inclusive reason is around page 394 or so. of esoteric psychology too. Then we learn what meticulous entirety is and how straight knowledge plays into that and pure reason and so forth. But when I want to go into what the Vedanta reveals and Brahmanism and the ancient mantra, thou art that, then I don't worry about pure reason. It's a different kind of intuition. I don't even know what to do with it except to call it infusception, which reveals the identicality which underlies all things. I hope that's a little bit clear.
So Heike responds, that's what I thought, because it is, quote, partial, unquote, to contemplate on one object subject. And then Joan asks, are there rings past not in consciousness?
Yes, there are, and we're constantly breaking them or expanding them or melting them away. Now, you know, of course, it's illusory what we're doing. I mean, you know, because ultimately when you think about what we are, the boundless immutable principle, there are no rings past not. It's boundless. You know, the ultimate reality is boundless. So there are no, and rings past not are boundaries. But for practical purposes in this universe of Mahamaya, the great Maya, consciousness has all kinds of rings past not. Let's just say that the ring past not of the consciousness of the planetary logos is immense when compared to the ring past not of a human being. And a solar logos has a much vaster ring past not of consciousness than has the planetary logos, but it's still limited, and on until we reach the ring past not of the consciousness of the universal logos. Now, you know, we would have no idea what that is, but all we know, it is as far as self-perception can go. When that self-perception deals with the unitariness or the oneness of the being itself. In other words, when the universal logos perceives itself as one, as an unarticulated one, as an indivisible one, that's its ring past not in consciousness. And compared to absolute infinity, which is super universal, that ring past not of the universal logos seeing itself as one is tiny, 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 next to nothing. So it's all, you know, relative comparison, basically. And the quick answer, of course, is yeah, we really do have rings past not of consciousness, each one of us, and they differ according to our development, and our job is to keep on pushing the boundary so that we are invested consciously in more and more of what the universal logos sees of itself, until one fine day be with us, we not only see what the universal logo sees of itself, but we are that perceiver, the universal logos, that self-perceiver, the universal logos itself. There's only one being in all of cosmos. Joan. Okay.
And Anne Veronica asks, does love and light we send out pass our ring pass knot and touch other consciousness?
Well, a ring pass knot is not necessarily at all limited to our aura. So our consciousness in group consciousness and progressive group consciousness is always wider and wider. And love and light widen that reach and expand the perimeter. So in fact, we are already stretched beyond just the immediacy of our local aura. And when we do send out love and light, of course, they do reach within the ring pass knot of our consciousness, the expanded part, and I think they do, in a way, penetrate beyond that periphery. And who knows how far it can extend before it starts to attenuate and become thinner and thinner, you know. So I would say the love and light sent out by a Christ or a Buddha has a tremendous expansion beyond their particular auric confines. And we have a lot less, but love and light are constantly expanding. They're not only they're expanding our ring pass knot, they're pushing the envelope, and they're also penetrating through that envelope to reach what we call apparent others, which are revealed not to be others at all when we are in the state of contemplation. So we all do have a certain locus, a certain scope, you know. We have a scope that our radiation can penetrate to, and it is beyond our local aura. And one day our ring pass knot will become very porous. Our auric ring pass knot will become very porous, and just like the Christ's, and it will present no obstacle to reaching apparent others. But we could not, with justification, say that the light and life, the light and light sent out by the Christ or radiated by the Buddha reach the far ends of the universe. That's just too much. It's like, you know, looking at the Christ with the Christians who say he's the only Son of God in all the universe. You know, it's just a faulty comparison. The magnitudes are just not considered there. There is a cosmic Christ, which is the second aspect of the great universal logos, but it's not the individual Christ who has a tremendous radiation of love and light and sacrificial will, yes, but not to the end of the ends of the universe. See, we have to get our magnitudes in adjustment, and that's called humility. An adjusted sense of right proportion. And if you look at some of the childish presentations of religion, you see they are not humble. They do not have humility. They exaggerate, they minimize. They do not hold things in right proportion. To call Christ the only Son of God is a gross misrepresentation of relative magnitudes. So yes, we can penetrate beyond our normal auric ring pass knot. How far it goes, it just depends on our initiatory level. You know, my thought at my present level of ignorance. Anything else, Michael?
I am seeing no hands raised and no other questions, comments have been posted at this period.
See, friends, you know what we're doing, or how I'm trying to respond to your questions, is to use the abstract mind to respond. You know, that's where we formulate our thoughts and our words on the highest part of the mental plane. And they are just hints at something we might realize. Now, on the fifth level down, down, up, okay, fifth level down of the atmic plane is a power or a city called realization. Realization is not the words in which realization is conveyed. The word, you know, the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, you know. We can be led to the water of reality, but we have to do the drinking. We can't have our head shoved under the water. So, realization can come to us on the basis of these abstract formulations. And when it comes to us, it will come to us in the heart, or our series of hearts. If the heart between the shoulder blades is connected with the buddhic plane, then the heart and the head has its monadic connection. And the causal body is said to be the heart center of the monad. And I just want to say that unless we can activate in a feeling way a heart, we're not going to get it. And getting it means like, aha, you know, and when we're talking about intuitions, it's a eureka, it's a aha, you know, like Master Kurumi, or as Pythagoras was said to have, I don't know what he was looking at, various triangles or musical relationships or whatever, but he's said to have shouted out, "Eureka, I have found it. There it is." And the aha is kind of the same thing. You get it, you see it. And just the abstract formulation on the higher level of the mind is a finger pointing the direction, but it's not yet the aha in you or any one who necessarily hears or reads what is formulated by the abstract mind. It can remain an abstraction. And yeah, it's a nice thought. It's interesting. Yes, yes. But it's not the aha. It's not eureka. And we're interested in those things. Ah, you know, the ah. Even just the word ah. Ah. Ah, I see it, you know. It signals a different relationship with what is seen. It is contemplative. You know, the big thing about contemplation, and I really do recommend reading what Alice Bailey has to say in From Intellect to Intuition about contemplation. Contemplation negates the distinction between the subject and the object. And if we really want to advance on the path of initiation and occultism, well, okay, we've got to do that. We've got to negate that apparent distinction. And, you know, it takes time, or maybe it happens suddenly, but the preparation for it has taken time. And we'll walk around in a permanent state of, ah, you know, we will see it, we'll get it, only to find out that the it we got was us. Okay, a little elaboration on that point. Anything else?
No hands, no additional comments.
I would just say, you know, trust yourself that inherent within you is not only the possibility, but the certainty that you are intuitive in the sense that DK has described it in the beginning of the Glamour book. It's just a question of uncovering the layers of the lower types of responses to lay bare the intuition which is resident within you. You know, in other words, have confidence in your approach to all this, as remote as it may seem and kind of abstruse and just terribly subtle and all that. Just have confidence that the revelation is always there. It's just a question of the revelation being revealed. And it will be. So, you know, you can't ever really say to yourself, oh, I just can't get that. I just can't get it. I don't understand it. No, never say that to yourself, because it is definitely resident within you, definitely. And it will be uncovered. Like DK said, all of us are naturally telepathic. It's just that we've covered it up with other preoccupations and lesser points of tension. We are telepathic. We are intuitive. You know, we are. So just have confidence in your pursuits of these matters, and they will slowly make themselves evident as realities. Okay, then, friends. Tomorrow morning, Glamour. I'm sure I'll be able to come up with some glamour, all of them related to the great heresy of separateness, all of them related to misidentification, the delusion, illusion, that we think we are this when we're not, and we're really that and not this, you know, words. So tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. GMT, we'll be working on that. And let's close with the great invocation. Okay. And let's see, is that what you're getting? Yeah, that is great invocation. Okay. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Thanks, everybody. And in the chat box, I think there are some links that you can avail yourself of. There's a GoToWebinar link, I think, for tomorrow morning, here in Europe anyway, morning, for the Glamour workshop. Not a workshop, it's, you know, presentation. And then at night, another link for Zoom for the Cosmic Fire in-depth discussion. And we're, you know, beginning a new section, and we're working on Fire by Friction, the foundational fire. A short section relatively compared to the immense section on solar fire in that great book. So maybe hope to see some of you there, and we will persist. Meanwhile, lots of love, many blessings, and thank you for showing up. And we'll be with you in a certain number of hours. Take care, and all the best to you. And by the way, all this will be on Makara, and eventually will be put on YouTube. So if you want to review what we've done, or you have any friends or people who might be interested in what we're doing, you can point them in that direction. Esoteric, I even forgot the name of our YouTube site. Well, it's esoteric something anyway. Education, probably. Moria Federation.
Moria Federation, esoteric education.
It was coming to me. See how the voice of God helps? Okay. See you. Thanks, Joe. And thanks, Michael. And thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.